You know, it's good to have good friends in high places, and that is who we're talking with here. Washington insider Dave Leventhal, a last-minute addition. And Dave, I could not be more thankful that you made some time for me this morning.
No, you're giving me far too much credit here. I'm just a kid from Kimmer West High School here, Joe Beamer.
Well, we're lucky to have you, Dave. And my first question is kind of a breaking situation where a Secret Service personnel shot an armed man in a confrontation near the White House. Is there anything more to this story?
Yeah, details are still coming out at this point, so we don't have a lot of facts on the ground beyond what you just said. I'm sure we will get more updates and more news in the hours to come, but it really reflects what has been the case over the past several years here, many years really, in Washington, D.C., which is that the White House grounds, the immediate grounds in front of the White House, behind the White House, have been flashpoints or areas of flashpoints for some tenuous situations, people trying to climb gates, fights breaking out, and in some disruptions that have led to ultimately police and law enforcement getting involved in sometimes violent fashion. So this is the way that things are operating here all too often, and here in the District of Columbia, where I now live and have for 16 years, and there definitely has been a change over the time that I've been here.
Dave, obviously I want to get to the speech the president gave on Tuesday, but we started the show talking with Toronto Sun's Brian Lilly, and you can probably guess what we talked about. Tariffs, obviously, and another whirlwind weekend when it comes to the administration and tariffs and responses from Mexico in Canada. Today, on March 9th, where do we stand in D.C. on tariffs to our neighbors to the south and the north?
And look, I'm not being glib here, Joe, by saying this, but we really don't have any idea where this is going to go. It's changed already several times. There's going to be tariffs. There's not going to be tariffs. There will be tariffs again. There's not going to be tariffs. And oftentimes it can come down to, as we saw this latest go around, phone calls that Donald Trump had with leaders in Mexico or leaders in Canada, and he can change his mind on a dime. So a lot of people who I've talked to are struggling to answer the question of, well, what is the game plan here? What exactly is Donald Trump trying to accomplish? Is he trying to secure the border? Is he trying to get the flow of fentanyl into this country mitigated or reduced? Is he trying to send a message to China? Is he just trying to create chaos and really show Mexico and Canada and China as well who's boss? It may be all of the above, and it may not necessarily be the same answer on the same given day. The bottom line is that it's created an incredible amount of chaos. We had the automakers who were apoplectic about the idea that the price of cars and the price of materials to build cars were likely going to go up by thousands of dollars per car in a very short period of time, begging the president to have a delay, to think this over. He ultimately did. We have other tariffs that are going forward. So this is not a black and white situation by any stretch of the imagination. It is a world of gray. It's a world of confusion. And again, that may be part of the point for the United States to any government under Donald Trump to signal to anyone out there, whether it is Canada, Mexico, China, or Europe for that matter, that the United States has the ability to control the world economy on the issue of tariffs as it sees fit, and nothing can stop Donald Trump from going ahead and doing it if he wants to.
But he does have Republicans that are pushing back. Our 10:30 guest, Congresswoman Tenney, I wouldn't say she was pushing back, but she said she was cautious. Obviously, she is in a border district, but she's not the only Republican speaking out against these tariffs.
Yeah, and there have been some Republicans who have spoken out. Look, if you live in a state or you represent a state, or if you're a member of the U.S. House of Representatives and you represent a district that could be profoundly affected by 25% tariffs, or you rely on exports, or for that matter, imports, and your constituents are demanding that these tariffs do not come into play, then you may be willing to speak out a little bit more than you were otherwise, or would be otherwise. But also, too, Republicans are really scared right now of doing anything that's going to cross Donald Trump. They don't want to be the next Republican who is charged of being a Republican in name only, a rhino. They don't want to be lit up on Truth Social by Donald Trump or on X by Elon Musk, who, of course, is playing such an outsized role in the government, despite holding no elected position. So when you add this all up together, Republicans are afraid of getting primaried. They're afraid of Elon Musk being willing to put millions or tens of millions of dollars against an effort into an effort against them the next time they're up for election. I've talked to numerous Republicans over the past many weeks about this, and this is something that comes up time and time again. There is a palpable concern and a palpable fear of if you go against Donald Trump, you know what you're going to get back if it's an issue that he cares about. And tariffs is one of them, because Donald Trump has been talking about tariffs ever since he started running for president. He's been talking about going forward with what he's been doing for years. So nobody should be surprised that it's happening, but people are absolutely scared, if you are an elected official and you are a Republican, of going too far and basically saying, Donald Trump, stop doing this.
Are there eyes on the prime minister? Not election tonight, when the Liberal Party will name its new leader. Any eyes on that in D.C., thinking that maybe that could start a new conversation between the two countries?
Yeah, maybe. It's definitely going to be of great interest, and could be something that changes the equation here. But what we see up in Canada, and I have lots of friends in Canada, as I expect lots of people do in Buffalo, Canadians are united in a way that I don't know if we've seen them united in a long, long time. They're angry. They feel betrayed, many of them. And this is conservatives and liberals in Canada, feeling as if the United States has stepped away from a friendship that we have enjoyed for decades and decades and decades, and are doing things to actively hurt or actively degrade our relationship with Canada. And that's not only through tariffs, but also Donald Trump's continuous rhetoric about Canada becoming the 51st state, which about zero people in Canada would actually like to see have happen. And of course, is nothing that is at all in any way, shape, or form feasible going forward. So, you know, this is something that obviously has huge implications on the way that Canada is going to respond. But, you know, it's also something, too, that has major economic factors to it that are very concerning, not only to Americans when we talk about tariffs, but Canada, who feels like its economy could be ruined by a trade war between the United States and Canada. And, you know, I'll say this about the economy. You know, the economy, it doesn't care what Donald Trump thinks, and the economy doesn't pay any attention to what Democrats think or feel. You know, our government can influence the economy on a fundamental level in certain respects, but it certainly can't control how people choose to spend or not spend their money. And it can't control how businesses decide to, you know, invest or not invest their money. But signals from the government when it comes to tariffs, when it comes to other types of actions, including government cuts, those will be inputs that will be pieces of information that help inform how businesses react. And it may not necessarily comport with Donald Trump's economic goals if ultimately these tariffs are affecting the U.S. economy in a negative way, and business decides to kind of just do its thing separate and apart from what Donald Trump wants.
And conservatives in Canada might be extra angry about this, because ever since this started, their poll numbers, it seemed like it was going to be a gimme for the Conservative Party to replace Justin Trudeau. But now, after all this talk, it's really hurt the conservatives in Canada.
Absolutely. And politics can change that quickly, and factors on the ground and forces that are contemporary can very much swirl an election and turn it inside out or upside down. We've seen that in the United States, and there's no reason to believe that that couldn't happen in Canada, too. We'll see what comes to pass, but that's something that absolutely is a factor right now.
Dave, when the president was talking about all the tariff stuff, Ukraine, Russia came up, and it seems like the president, for the first time in a while, has given a threat towards Russia if they don't come to the table for peace.
Yeah, and he has, but at the same time, too, he's been back on Ukraine in the same breath as well. This is all part of what is very overtly a strategy to try to, from the Trump administration, be a broker, be a peacemaker, try to bring the two sides together. Is that going to be effective? Well, that remains to be seen at this point. But the bigger issue here, at least on a global scale, is, you know, you think back to kind of what the Soviet Union was hoping for in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s during the height of the Cold War. They were always agitating and hoping and trying to spur what they like to call a decoupling of the United States and Europe. And what we're seeing right now, Joe, is, at least in part, a decoupling of the United States in Europe. So Vladimir Putin can't feel bad about that. This is something that, obviously, in the sort of Soviet philosophical vein that he thinks in so often, is something that he would love to see happen, where Europe and the United States are more divided than they are apart. It was notable that Donald Trump, in his 100-minute speech that he gave earlier this week to the joint session of Congress, he didn't mention by name any of our European allies that you would expect him to mention in the context of Ukraine and Russia or just the situations in general in Europe. He didn't mention the UK. He didn't mention Germany. Didn't mention France. Didn't mention NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization that has been the military alliance that the United States has been a cornerstone of in the post-World War II era. And, you know, sometimes you focus so much on what a president says in a speech like that, whether it's this joint session address or a traditional State of the Union address. And sometimes you need to pay attention to what he doesn't say. And I thought it was very telling that Donald Trump, although he was very focused on Russia and Ukraine, was just kind of cutting out a lot of the other players who potentially could be major factors in the way that this war comes to a resolution, or for that matter, does not come to a resolution anytime soon.
Dave, the speech, as you mentioned, on Tuesday, obviously a lot of stuff Trump said we can get into, but it's really the actions of the Democrats not standing for stuff Trump says. Okay, that's understandable, but not standing for anything. You know, I've talked to Democrats here, obviously not in Congress, but Democrats here who said, you know, not standing for the 13-year-old with cancer or the gentleman who was in... who was taken hostage in Russia, like not standing for those things, kind of left a bad taste in their mouth. What are you hearing in D.C.?
Yeah, well, very few people who I've talked to about this felt that the Democrats had, in general, are mustering any type of really coherent response to anything that they say that they don't like about what Donald Trump is doing. And to say that the Democratic performance during the address was flaccid would probably be an understatement in the minds of many liberals out there who felt like the Democrats on that night didn't do much of anything of note and aren't in general doing anything of note. I mean, let's put it this way. The Democrats don't have a face right now. They don't have a leader or somebody who would be even beginning to be akin to an opposition figure to Donald Trump. Their collective response has been muted. And oftentimes, you know, Democrats are not speaking out because they're afraid of what might come back at them. They're going to get lit up on social media. They're going to have threats that are logged to their offices or even personal threats. This is a real thing, I should note, too. And it's true for Republicans and Democrats, but there are death threats of really ugly, ugly, ugly stuff that is happening to politicians. So, look, you can be the most conservative or liberal person in the world, but I would hope that most Americans would agree that making threats on the lives of elected officials or public servants is not a good thing. But this is happening so often here in Washington, D.C., and again, seems to be happening at a clip that far exceeds anything that we would ever be talking about, even if we were having this conversation 10 years ago.
It's absolutely despicable. I've said this before. I think, you know, people have got to stop making personal attacks because of policy differences. Like you, Dave, I wish that we could say that everyone feels that way.
Well, you know, you can agree or disagree with anyone's politics, but if you're like, you should die because of this, or you should be killed because of this, or I wish to bring you harm because of this, or you spout off on Facebook in a way that is talking about hurting somebody's family, like that's awful and it's gross, and you know, people just need to think a little bit more before they speak or they act in that kind of way. It's just really not going to be helpful, except maybe to, you know, make you feel better in some kind of perverse way in the moment.
Absolutely. You know, you talk about the Democrats not having, you know, a face. It does seem a little different than 2016. It seems like when Donald Trump won in 2016, the Democrats had their plan of attack and, you know, rode that to a midterm victory and obviously a 2020 victory. Any idea of what's different this time around?
The wind just got completely taken out of their sails. Or if you're, you know, a Bills fan back in the 80s and remember Hank Bulla, you know, the sails got taken out of the the winds. But I mean, it's just completely different in so many respects, and in that there was just no plan B. It was Kamala Harris was going to win this or what? And there was no answer, and there has been no answer. And yes, you have some Democrats who are trying to talk a strong game. Chuck Schumer's out there doing Chuck Schumer things and going on TV, and Hakeem Jeffries in sort of a very low beat kind of way is talking out against Donald Trump. But it's pretty perfunctory, and it's not anything that has really made an effect, made an impact on the public consciousness in any meaningful way. It's been Donald Trump all the time dominating the discourse and driving what's happening in this country. Anything else has largely just been reactive. So is that going to change for Democrats? I don't think it's going to change anytime soon. Somebody's going to have to emerge here, and nobody has at this point. So, of course, we have a midterm election coming up, and we, by the end of this year, in earnest, will have candidates running against candidates, and then that will be in play. But you know, there's just nothing right now that you can point to say that Kamala Harris has still been the face of the Democratic Party. I mean, she's largely gone silent, save for a couple of statements and appearances here and there. And obviously, Joe Biden has just faded to black in terms of the role that he's playing in the national stage. And Barack Obama, no, he's not really a factor yet. There's nobody that you can point to. I mean, Pete Buttigieg maybe has been, the former transportation secretary, the most outspoken, but largely on issues that relate to transportation and other things that were under his purview. But you know, you couldn't hold him up as sort of the avatar of the Democratic Party at this point, because there really is no person of that sort.
Dave, we dodged a rematch. You know, last Saturday, my Hokies came back in overtime against the Orange. And if things had worked out a little differently yesterday, we could have met each other in the first round of the ACC tournament.
Yeah, maybe. Syracuse not having the greatest season in the world right now. But the better football season than basketball season.
The beautiful part about basketball is, hey, if they get hot for the ACC tournament, they could punch a ticket.
That this is always true. You always hold out hope until the very last second. But yeah, we'll see how much hope there is to be held out.
That is true. Hey, Dave, I want to thank you again. I really, really appreciate you jumping on with such short notice. Like I said, it's good to have good friends in high places, and I thank you so much.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks so much, Joe.